What percentage of the people that you talk to would go on to make into your story?
Oh, that's a great question. What percentage of the people I interview made it into the book, into the exhibit? So for my first book, this black and white one, I interviewed 52 people, and there are 52 people in the book. So that is to say that I never talked to anybody and got to the end of it and said, well, that's not very interesting. I think everybody has an interesting story to share. As a journalist, maybe it's my job to dig it out, to encourage it, and to nudge it. For this book, I interviewed 100 people, and we've got, 58, I think, in the book. We simply didn't have the room. The more pages you put in a book, the more expensive it becomes, and we didn't have the resources. So we had to make some choices, and that was a really hard choice. And some of it fell to demographics. Oops, I've got more men than I've got women. If we have to lose some stories, let's lose some male stories so it evens out. Or down south, I've got, you know, too many African-American voices and not enough of other perspectives. And so we would try to balance that out. I did make an intentional effort to call everybody who didn't make it into the book to explain to them why. And that was a really hard couple of days. Because no matter how many ways you explain that, we don't have enough room, and then all people hear is, oh, so my story's not good enough. So that was a little challenging. But I felt like it was important to have that conversation with them. At some point, they'll probably wind up on the website, because all of these stories also exist online. And so you can go online and you can hear the person in the recorded audio tell their story, hear the cadence of their voice and the Cajun shrimpers, accent. It's kind of fun to hear. Yeah.
What surprised you?
What surprised me? I think the biggest surprise, again and again, for this project is when people found themselves in extraordinarily difficult circumstances, in really difficult scenarios, and they found ways to respond positively. You know, it's easy to be peaceful and happy and gentle with others when everything is going well for you, but when you're feeling the pressure of life, when you find yourself in crisis, when you find yourself with a new challenge, it becomes harder to think about other people. We get absorbed with ourselves. And so I think the thing that consistently surprised me was people who were in dire circumstances who found ways to create positive change. Yeah.
In talking to these people, how often did national political tribalism come into the discussion? What ideas did some of them have about ways to combat that?
Yeah, that's interesting. So the question is that, you know, how often did ideas of political tribalism and conflict enter into the conversation? What were some of the ways people suggested that we combat that? And the first answer is quite often. I mean, when people talk about issues of peace, they're either going to talk about political peace or spiritual peace or inner peace. Those are kind of the three breakdowns. And now, mind you, these stories were done before our most recent election cycle. And so I suspect some people might have different opinions now. I suspect all of us, our ideas change and evolve and grow. I hope that that's the case. But even so if it was 3 years ago or 4 years ago that I did these interviews, people still were acknowledging and feeling that welling presence of political animosity. And really, the biggest solution to that was turn off the media and talk to people. Right? Shut off the voices that tell you what the other side believes and go talk to someone from the other side. And it's it's simple. It's not rocket science. But I think that so much of the noise we hear in the media around political discourse is fed to us, and it's fed to us to stir up animosity. And I promise you, there are people in this project who fall on the opposite side of the political spectrum, as I did. But that doesn't mean we can't still find a way to get along. That doesn't mean we can't still find common ground. And we're not going to agree on everything, but I can see value in them as a human being. So much of what happens is this notion of oh shoot, now the word leaves me. Oh no, I was feeling so smart, and then the word went away. Wait for it. Wait. Nope, not going to come. Confirmation bias, there it is. Confirmation bias, is that a term that you're familiar with? Where you have a certain belief in place, and you gather all of the information you can that supports your belief and tells you that you're right, and you work overtime to ignore anything that challenges that belief. Right? And so I think we spin into a downward cycle around these ideas of confirmation bias, and it happens around race, and it happens around religion, and it happens around politics, and we are told over and over again that that side is trying to destroy the country, and that side doesn't know what they're doing, and that side is evil, and we lose our view of humanity of that side. And I think what becomes imperative is that we establish those relationships, that we continue those relationships. We don't isolate into our little silos, but we continue to engage in practical ways. That's easier said than done, I know, but I think it's the only solution. Because once we go down the slope of demonizing the other, there's really no retreat from that. Yeah, we objectify them. Yeah.
Did you change?
Do I change?
After this journey. Did it?
Honey, you want to take that one?
All right, no comment. I would like to believe that I might have been a better and more patient parent had I started this process earlier. I think I have become less activist and knee-jerk response to a lot of issues, and I've been much more willing to see the subtle nuance in issues and to understand the complexity of things. I think early on when I started, I was as willing as anybody to boil things down to simple black and white issues, and as it turns out, the world is not that simple. And so I think that I've become much more patient with people who disagree with me and much more willing to sort of explore the nuance in the issues and much less willing to reject people who disagree with me. And that's probably an ongoing thing. You know, I don't think you get there and you're done with it. I think it's a continual process. Good question.
How old are your children?
Oh, how old are our children? We've got a 20-year-old daughter who's in art school producing beautiful things, and we've got a 23-year-old son who lives three blocks away from us, who does sound and lights for live events. So right now he's at Winnebago Fest in Iowa doing lighting for a Lee Greenwood concert. So that's what he does. Anyway, I have a dog who's sad because I'm gone a lot. Yeah.
In your discussions with these various folks, to what degree did religious faith or religious beliefs come into play in terms of how they found peace?
Yeah. So in the conversations, to what degree did religious faith come into it? And I think I'm not a good math person, but I think the statistics would be a pretty good reflection of who we are as Americans. And so a lot of the people in their conversations were more agnostic and secular in their conversations. But then there were a lot of people who found that their notion of peace was really closely tied to their religious identity, whether that be Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, you know, you name it. I think, you know, for me, and if you come to Monday Morning Musings, is that what we call it? Thank you. Little pitch there. We'll talk a lot more about my notions of faith and how my faith has informed my interest in exploring these ideas. And at the end of the day, I'll give a little bit of it away. I'm not much of a theologian, but I remember the part where Jesus said, love one another. You know, and I don't think there were a lot of exceptions to that. And so for me, this has been a process in exploring what that means to me. What does it mean to love somebody with really different views than me? Do I need to change them? Do I need to fix them? Is there a way that we can engage without doing that? It's a lot of pressure on me to fix everybody in the world. I don't know, maybe you all are better at it.
But that's a lot of pressure, and I think we come at conversations and very quickly enter into the point where we have to tell that person they're wrong. And what if we could just suspend that a little bit? I mean, when I'm in a conversation with a Muslim, there are a lot of things theologically that we disagree on. I mean, they have some of the same prophets, Abraham and Moses, and they recognize Jesus, not as a resurrected Jesus, but as a prophet in the lineage. So there are a lot of things we disagree on, but there are some things that we agree on. What if I could enter that conversation without having to convert them? You know, there are times, this is an easier and softer conversation about interfaith dialogue when we talk about a Buddhist-Christian conversation, because nobody's upset with the Buddhists in the world. You know, you can sit down and you can have an hour-long conversation, and I'm never trying to convert Eric to be a Lutheran, and he's never trying to convince me to be a Buddhist. But every once in a while, he can share a story that I recognize from my tradition, and I can say, oh yeah, we talk about that too in this slightly different way. And there you've got some common ground, and there you've got a foothold of a relationship. And I don't have to fix Eric, I don't have to change Eric, that's a lot of pressure. Someone else can take care of what Eric needs to do, but we can still have a conversation. So I would say across the religious traditions, probably 50% of the people that I interview, that enters into the conversation at some point. What else? Yeah?
I would assume that you had some sense of what peace means to you when you started the project. How has that changed, and what does it mean to you today?
Yeah, so if I had some sense of peace at the beginning of the project, how has that changed, and what does it mean today? And I think my peace was directly tied to politics and social justice activism back when I started the project. And I think over time, it has become a lot more personal. It has become a lot more relational in that there seem to be some things that operate in the world that apparently are out of my control. And it's important that I stay informed about those things, and it's important that I participate in those things. But there are more human levels that I do have control over, how I treat people, how I engage with people on a day-to-day basis, and those things have taken more center stage for me, I think, as the project has gone on, the things that I can control. So. Yeah.
Did you find any meaningful differences in talking to people with different age groups, young, middle-aged, older, perception of things?
Yeah, interesting. Do I find a difference in age groups in the conversations? And I have to think that through a little bit. Clearly, older folks have had more experiences to draw on. I mean, the youngest person that I interviewed in this collection, I think, was 9 years old. So there's a different way of understanding the world when you're 9 years old than when you're 51 or when you're 70. There's more experience that you can draw on, but I think there's incredible wisdom in some of the young voices. You know, I don't see generational shifts as much as I see shifts in individuals. And I say the same thing about geography. You know, I don't necessarily see regional differences in what people think about peace. I think it has more to do with the individuals that I chose to talk to. So I guess I don't see great trends. One thing that I see in my own kids, who grew up during, you know, being very aware of the recession, being very aware of terrorism, things like that as they were growing up, is one of two things happens with them. Either there's a defeatist attitude of, well, nothing really matters anyway because these things are swirling around and so big and so out of control. Or I see young people who feel particularly engaged and particularly empowered to try to create change in their own way. And that looks different than, I think, activism of the past. But I think, like everybody else, they'll find their own way. What else? Yeah?
Can you describe a personal moment when you experienced peace yourself through this project?
Yeah, when I took off my coat because it was really warm. No, let's see. There are all sorts of examples. I think there are so many examples. And again, this talks a little bit about faith, I think. There's so many examples of things that I think could not have happened if I didn't have my faith. There are so many moments. So not a particular interview per se, although there are lots of those moments, but there were a lot of times when I should have or could have quit. I think there's a fine line between, when you're pursuing your dream, there's a fine line between foolish and visionary. And you don't really know which side of that line you're going to fall on when you're working on it. And I'm not willing to claim visionary, but I feel like every day the needle moves a little further away from foolish. And so the courage and the stubborn determination to keep going on this when it seemed like there was no reason to do it and there was no way it was going to work, I think continues to be my aha moment, that I'm doing what I should be doing. And it's okay to walk far out on that limb where it's not secure and there are no promises and you don't know if it's going to work out okay. And if you have faith, you can find a way to make it work. I think more than anything, that's been my aha moment, and I hope that my kids have seen it too. Yeah.
Were there any moments where you that you just had tears?
Yeah, about 80% of the interviews. When I feel like we all walk around with this stuff inside that we really want to share, and I feel like our day-to-day lives don't often give us that opportunity. And when somebody sits down with you and says, it's important for me to know what you think, I want to listen to what you have to say, that's a powerful thing. And people will share very powerful and personal and private things. And I'm prone to be a crier anyway at a well-crafted passage in a novel or a beautiful song lyric or certain scenes of a movie like Finding Nemo. I tend to well up a bit. And so they will start to cry and I will start to cry. And it's a really, these interviews are an hour long typically, but they're a really powerful hour. Yeah.
Do you still have relationships with these folks?
Yeah, a lot of them. Probably 40% of these people I've seen in the last year. Maybe that's high, maybe 30% of people. But I'll go far out of my way. If I'm close to somebody, I'll call them up and say, hey, I'm going to be going through. Just last year, we were down in Memphis, and Elaine Baker, right back there, from Mound Bayou, Mississippi. I interviewed Elaine at her church, her Baptist church in Mound Bayou, because her faith was really important to her. And I interviewed her on a Saturday, and she said, well, can you stay for church tomorrow? And I couldn't, because I had to get on to my next interview. But last year, we were in Memphis, and I called her up 2 years ago?
Yes,
2 years ago. I called her up and I said, Elaine, my wife and I are going to be in your neighborhood. We can run down and say hi. And she said, well, can you come on a Sunday this time? And I said, well, how's that going to be with a couple of white Northern Lutherans being in your church? And she said, well, you'll be the only ones, but we'd love to have you. And it was 2 hours of sheer joy and singing and people who couldn't sit still in their seats, and they'd run to the back and they'd run back to the front. And we got to the end, and I mean, we couldn't get out of there because people were welcoming us. And I said to the pastor, I said, you know, we Lutherans tend to sit on our hands when we praise Jesus, and you all don't seem to have that same problem. And he said, oh, there's no right way to praise the Lord. This is just how we do it. And so I will go out of my way to see people, and probably 50 or 60% I see on social media, and we stay in touch that way. But yeah, I've got 30% I've seen in the last year. And it's one of the great joys. So realized just a short time ago that next April 16th is the 10-year anniversary of the very first interview I did for the project, a woman named Barbara Nordstrom Loeb. And so I emailed her and I said, Barbara, if we have an event, will you come and can we sit down and do a public interview of you, re-interview you and ask how your ideas have changed over 10 years? And so I just had coffee with the very first person last week. So yeah, it's a treat. Yeah.
What's your next project?
Oh, great question. There are five of them happening at the same time. So I'm right now writing my memoir, my story, A Piece of My Mind, Lessons on the Road to Peace. Both of these books were self-published because photo books are expensive to produce. I actually had a publisher offer to publish this book, faith-based publisher, which is great because I'm a faith-based person, but they were more conservative than me and they said, we'd love to publish your book if you just remove the voices of the gay and the lesbian people from it. And I said, so you want me to take a project about talking to people, no matter whether you agree with them or not, and then remove the voices of the people you disagree with? And they said, yeah. And I said, no. So, actually, I'm going to tell you a little aside that's really sweet for that, and then I'll answer the rest of your question. The day after our book release party, I went and I talked with a group of fifth graders, and a little girl raised her hand and she said, have you ever talked to anyone from a family where there's a mom and a dad but they're the same thing? And I had to scratch my head for a second and I said, wait, you mean a gay or a lesbian couple? And she said, yeah. And I said, sure, Laura Patey, second woman in the book, second story in the book. She is married to another woman. They adopted a couple of kids out of the foster care system, raised them as their own. Absolutely, she's in the book too. She said, okay, thanks. And she sat for a second and she said, because I've got two moms. And I thought, what would that have been like for her if I would have said, yeah, sure, we've talked to those people, but we don't include those stories in the book. I think that ability to say to someone, I see you, and I hear you, and you have value, and you have worth, is a really powerful thing. And so I knew that was the right decision for me. It was confirmed the morning after a book release party by that little girl. So I'm working on the memoir, hoping to find a publisher for that one. Memoir is usually about 80 to 90,000 words. I'm 45,000 words into it, so we're making good progress. Then I'm talking with the State Department and Pax Christi International about doing an international version. This book was all Minnesota. This is from across the United States. And I think it will be possible to do an international version. I don't know how all the logistics and cost and funding of that are going to work, but I haven't understood that about any of the books to this point. So we just, you know, you can see a couple steps ahead of you. So you take those two steps, and then you can see a couple more steps. And so we'll keep doing that. So an international project, but then also we have had a lot of loss in our life, some of it fairly recent. And I would like to do a series of stories about end of life, about recognizing our own mortality, A Piece of My Mind, Parting Wisdom, and talk about grief and loss and facing our own mortality. I think we don't do that well in our country, and I think it could be a great resource for other people who are doing that. So then I'd like to do one of all famous people, one of all kids, maybe go back and re-interview all the people that I interviewed a while ago, and that will bring us to 2030, and then I'll decide what to do next. I think this is what I'll do for the rest of my working life. One more, last question, and then I'll hang around if anybody else wants to talk.
Do you interview people like in gangs or the criminal that are in jail and that type of stuff?
Yeah, Tyrone works. Honey, do you know where Tyrone is?
He's back there.
He's back there. Served 36 years of a life sentence for second degree murder. His sentence was commuted, and now he works with at-risk youth. Hashim Garrett, do we know where Hashim is? Well, you'll have to wander around and find Hashim. Hashim joined a gang in Brooklyn when he was 12 years old. When he was 15, he was shot in the back and paralyzed from the waist down. He has this beautiful quote, which is, I want to get it right, I'm going to read it to you. Hashim's is the first story in the book. Here, so if you want to read it, it's this one, go find Hashim. He says, I want to love those who haven't shown me love, and I want to be kind to those who may not deserve my kindness. And that's probably a pretty good place to end. Thank you for coming.
We're going to introduce John Sunday morning. Of course, it's King's Brass, so we'll have just a couple minutes to give a teaser. He has an open house here tomorrow.
Am I saying something Sunday?
No, you don't have to say.
Oh, okay.
If you'd like to.
Pretty in white.
Well, no. But is the open house tomorrow or Saturday?
Saturday, from 10:30 till 12:30.
One of the things that John does so well is to draw out people's ability to tell your own story. And we're so hoping that people will be thinking about their Equus story in regards to next summer. It's one of the reasons this year made sense to bring you here. But then, hopefully people will see it at Church Sunday, but I hope you'll tell people about what we've had here tonight so that a lot of people who weren't able to be here tonight will be at Musings.
Yeah.
Another time, and we want to interface with him. So please go out and spread the word. Be good representatives for all of us. This has been great, John. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. I'll hang around.